Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, Johannesburg gets a financial lifeline, but Treasury has put the struggling city on notice. New Iran turmoil is sending oil higher and inflation fears with it. A UIF governance crisis raises fresh questions over worker protection. And South Africa does look better financially, but should investors really be bringing money back home? It's Thursday, the 9th of July. Now, Johannesburg has been given a breathing space, with National Treasury confirming the city's new budget is funded. But it is hardly, let me tell you, a clean bill of health. A 23 billion rand backlog in irregular and wasteful expenditure, strained cash flow, service delivery issues, unpaid bills to Eskom and Rand Water all point to a struggling metro still under intense pressure. So I want to discuss whether this is a turnaround or maybe just a temporary reprieve. I'm going to talk to Chris Hutting, who is Executive Director of the Center for Risk Analysis. Chris, this story is becoming more and more difficult and complex. As I speak, is this a lifeline now for Johannesburg, or Treasury just delaying the inevitable?
Jeremy, thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss. As someone who lives in Johannesburg, I desperately do want things to function as above board, as effectively as possible, for services to be delivered, all that kind of thing. So it's all really coming to a head now. I do think this follows on numerous warnings that the Treasury and the Minister of Finance, Minister Gorongwana, have delivered to the city of Joburg, to Mayor Marrero, for a few instances now. So it's part of a longer term process. I do think elements of it could sort of be a shock to the system, to help the city management realize the dire situation in which they find themselves, as some of them had not yet acknowledged that. In terms of whether this actually fixes things or changes things, we'll need to see how the city reacts to this, and then what steps Treasury, maybe other government departments, national government, cabinet, what they take to support this initiative by Treasury. Of course, the city of Joburg isn't the only one included in this list of the equitable share payments being frozen for July. But it does point to this is a long-term situation in which Johannesburg finds itself, and it's going to take serious work to get it back into a fiscally healthy position.
How can a budget be technically funded if the city is still in such financial distress?
So just in terms of basic, I guess, projections in terms of revenue expenditure, if one looks at it from a very basic balance sheet point of view, for a given budget cycle of given 12 months, the Treasury and the city of Joburg in this instance, they will have assessed that those numbers match with each other and talk to each other. So this doesn't take into account other debts owed to creditors, all that kind of thing. So it's only for this particular budget in isolation. I don't think it's not from Treasury's side a comment or a judgment call on the long-term fiscal situation in which the city of Johannesburg finds itself. I should perhaps also add, on the day that we're recording, the 9th of July, according to reporting in Bloomberg, the mayor of Johannesburg, Dada Marrero, has said that the city will pay around 2.4 billion rand to creditors, including Rand Water and Eskom, by mid-July. So hopefully this indicates that the city realizes, look, yes, your current budget, the next projected budget, is quote-unquote funded, but you need to make sure that your long-term commitments to various institutions, including Eskom and Rand Water, that those are paid. Otherwise, Treasury is going to take further steps.
And therein lies the risk.
Right. Yeah, 100%. I do want to give Treasury credit for taking this step. One would, I guess, many South Africans would say a local government election year, there's no way National Treasury would do this kind of thing to the most important, economically important metro in the country that's responsible for about 15% of GDP. But it really points to where the city of Joburg finds itself. And if Treasury didn't take this step, I guess the cycle just continues. It doesn't, I don't want to make it out to say, oh, if Treasury didn't take the step, Johannesburg would fail tomorrow. It's more of a long-term process in terms of things like fiscal credibility, investor sentiment, service delivery, providing to households and businesses the services for which they pay revenue, rates and tariff revenue. But yeah, I think the risk is really to the economy as a whole, the South African economy, if Johannesburg doesn't get its house in order.
A lot of this is dependent, as I understand it, or if I'm hearing you correctly, on future modelling. But Chris, we know that revenue projection is not a precise science, and there's also mounting interest on the bill.
Yes, 100%. If we look at things like irregular expenditure, I mean, how much that has grown over the past few years amongst not only the city of Johannesburg, but all other, most other municipalities in the country. If one doesn't sort of arrest that situation, if you don't deal with your debt repayments and the interest on that debt, you really shrink room for things like service delivery and CapEx, so investing in infrastructure, all those kinds of things that a metro, a municipality ought to be providing to households and to businesses. So I think getting Joburg right really is vitally important. And just on the point about declining revenue, so many households and businesses have where they were able to invest it in things like private electricity, in terms of private water, reticulation as well, private security. All of those things have also cramped revenue available to the city of Johannesburg. So they really need to make a case for themselves as much as possible. And it also comes in the context of rates that increased again in July, where rates continue to increase year after year. But do citizens and households feel that they're receiving the services for which they pay more every year?
Chris, from a risk management perspective, Treasury has chosen pressure rather than intervention or administration. Do you think that's strong enough?
I think as in a sort of initial step, it is strong in and of itself. We will have to see what steps are taken next, and again, how the city of Johannesburg reacts to this. Does it, you know, in rhetoric or in action, double down, or does it in a more, I guess, self-effacing, humble manner say, look, we acknowledge these issues and we're going to take whatever steps we and you as National Treasury think are necessary. So yeah, I'd want to give Treasury credit for the initial step. We just have to see now how this process unfolds. And just to highlight again the sort of context of a local government election year, I mean, that might also provide other pressure points between Treasury, between the city of Joburg, between the Gauteng government and the city of Joburg, or agreement between them. It adds more wrinkles to a very difficult fiscal situation in which Johannesburg finds itself.
Chris Hutting, thank you very much indeed. He is the executive director at the Center for Risk Analysis.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Oil prices have jumped again as renewed conflict between the United States and Iran threatens the fragile ceasefire and again puts the Strait of Hormuz back at the center of global market anxiety. And for South Africa, this is not a distant geopolitical story. A higher oil price feeds directly into fuel costs, inflation pressure, interest rate expectations, and obviously our currency. So let's try and understand the new economic fallout from well-known economist Iraj Abedian joins us. Iraj, welcome to you. This latest oil spike that we are seeing, just under $80 a barrel, short-term panic or the start, do you think, of a more durable shock?
I think it's a short-term one, Jeremy, because the two warring parties, the United States and the Iranian regime, both of them, for completely different reasons, are not willing or able to sustain a protracted war. But they are very, very different in terms of their expectations of what ceasefire means, the expectations of what the final settlement will be, and expectations, importantly, of the timeline. President Trump wants to do it quick. The Iranian regime wants to drag it over years. That is their expertise, and they've made an art of it. So I think There will be skirmishes, there will be volatile and aggressive responses, but neither of them can sustain. Especially the Iranian regime does not have the economic and the financial means in a country where inflation is now almost triple digit and government unable to pay its wages and even the Islamic Republic Guard is unable to sustain it. So in that context, this will be a spike, and in the next week or so, some or other mediation will bring calm back to the market.
And it's always about finding a balance, I guess, because markets are driven by practicality and also sentiment. So some of this is real supply risk, but a lot of it is also driven by fear.
Absolutely. I think one of the important reasons why this has sort of flared up, so to speak, is because for the first time since the war started back in February, all the major Western economies, France, Germany, UK, and US, have worked with Oman to create a pathway in the territorial waters of Oman through the Strait of Hormuz that would totally bypass the so-called territorial regions or sea segment or strait segment of Iran. And that is basically disarming the Iranian regime of any claim or any interference. And the Iranian regime doesn't want that. But I think for very good geopolitical as well as economic reasons, the Western powers, as well as China and India, are supportive of that. 30 other countries are supporting of this scheme. And if that, in one way or another, in the next 2 weeks is established, then the flow of oil, as well as the flow of other items such as fertilizer, aviation fuel, et cetera, will be a lot more regularized, a lot more certain, and therefore prices will come to a new equilibrium.
Iraj, is the Strait of Hormuz right now the single biggest risk in the global economy?
Not quite. It's the single most visible risk, but there are equally other risks that are associated with that if this is not managed properly, because it has the potential, Jeremy, of becoming the thin end of the wedge where it mutates into a global battle between Russia and China on the one hand and America on the other. Because this Strait of Hormuz, if it's not settled properly and calmly, it leads to the next bottleneck in the global economy, especially in the sea freight, which is in the Red Sea area, and Yemen is involved there. If that becomes a norm, other straits around the globe can become also hot spots, and then it becomes very quickly a very different kind of geopolitical, not just confined to the Strait of Hormuz, but affecting almost 60% of the global trade, not just fuel trade overall. And that can become a geopolitical issue, which is a major risk to avoid.
We also need to be on our toes here because a higher oil price obviously feeds into South African fuel prices fairly quickly, and that obviously changes the inflation outlook for South Africa.
Absolutely. And that brings us to a different issue altogether that South Africa has been, unfortunately, and in my view, misguidedly avoiding exploitation of its own natural gas and offshore oil and fuel more broadly. To the extent that South Africa, for reasons that are inexplicable technically, has avoided that, it leaves the economy vulnerable to this type of disruptions. So one of the issues that we must learn from this, or one of the lessons that we must learn from the current situation, is South Africa needs to pay a lot more attention as a matter of national priority to exploiting and exploring opportunities for its own home-based sources of natural energy.
What's it going to take then for us to get our head out the sand?
Well, it takes the Department of Minerals and Energy and the cabinet more broadly to bring the role players in the private sector and the government to accelerate the exploitation of these resources, as opposed to playing ideological games and just playing, kicking the can down the road, which we have been doing it for almost 10 years.
Is there private sector appetite for this kind of venture or exploration?
Absolutely. Exploration is done for part of it. The Kudu fields are already explored 15, 16 years ago, to the best of my knowledge. And Shell, we know, had opportunities in the Karoo, but all of that requires careful national attention. And very importantly, the global market is very open from the United States to Europe. They are very keen to investing in any opportunity that diversifies away from the Middle East to other regions of the globe. And Southern Africa is a very important part because already, Jeremy, Namibia and Mozambique have become increasingly a source of petrochemical industry and the exploitation or extraction rather than exploitation has already begun. So it's not something that is theoretical or imaginary. It is happening in the neighborhood, and South Africa must join for protecting its national interest.
And Iraj, just a final one then, and bringing it right back home and into our pockets. If the situation persists in the short to medium term, inevitably this could delay interest rate cuts.
Absolutely. And in worse, if even worse, if this sort of escalates too quickly and drags on for 2-3 months, the Reserve Bank may actually end up having to push the interest rates up and not wait until this settles down. Because the two players, both the Iranian regime and the American government, Mr. Trump in particular, are highly volatile, unpredictable. So they are very capable of creating very irrational and volatile conditions because of their different and conflicting, vastly conflicting postures in geopolitical terms.
Dr. Iraj Abedian is the founder and chief executive of Pan African Investment and Research Services, also the chairman of Pan African Capital Holdings. Iraj, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, business and labor do not often agree, but on the unemployment insurance fund, they seem to be saying much the same thing. The fund is in deep trouble. Business Unity South Africa has now pulled out of the UIF board and wants a forensic investigation and the fund placed under administration. COSATU also sounding the alarm, warning that the latest appointment of an acting UIF commissioner is raising serious governance concerns. So let's get a view now from COSATU. I'm in conversation with Matthew Parks, who is the Federation's parliamentary coordinator. Matthew, let's start very simply here. What is COSATU's main concern about what is happening at the fund?
Our concern is that the funds are in a crisis. There's just chaos. They've been poorly run. The IT systems are not fit for purpose. And as a consequence, employers struggle to register workers. Workers struggle to apply and receive their funds. Workers can wait days at a time in the labor centers queuing to apply for their funds. Workers can wait months and years to receive their funds. And that really has a huge impact upon workers who need this relief when they're on maternity leave, when they're retrenched, when they're injured, or when they pass away. There's been countless allegations of serious corruption, and it's been going for long. We've raised it for 6 years now at the Department of Labor as business and labor at NEDLAC. We've had no practical plan to turn things around. There are no permanent commissioner of the UIF or the compensation fund. There is no plan to fix them, and the consequence is workers pay the price.
And just to put this into context, because of the situation as it exists now, this potentially affects tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people.
It does. So when mothers go on maternity leave, we've had countless complaints from workers giving birth to the child. The child is now at crèche. They haven't received the maternity leave payments. We have workers who lose their jobs, battle to pay for the electricity, for food, to feed their kids, pay the bonds. They have money in the UF, but they can't get it because of the endless delays. We've had to intervene ourselves time and again as COSATU. And even we struggle to get the UF colleagues sorted out. So it really is a crisis. And these funds are paid for by employers and employees. And it's a crisis that needs to be addressed.
The organization BUSA, Business Unity South Africa, as I said, wants a forensic investigation into the UIF spending. Would you support that move?
We would, and that's something we've also called for as well. The SIU, the Hawks need to be deployed to deal with the issues of corruption. We need to make sure the monies of workers are safe, and that when you put in place a new system, that you've removed elements of corruption. Because otherwise, if you just put in place a new system and you retain the corrupt elements, you won't resolve anything. You'll continue with the corruption.
Busa also wants the fund placed under administration. Would COSATU support that? Or, Matthew, could you be worried, might you be worried that it could weaken Labour's voice?
No, we've made the same call as organised Labour, as COSATU. There's a need for new management. There's a need to clean up the system. There's a need to remove corrupt elements. And this must be dealt with. We've engaged politely for 6 years. We can see no result. And the fundamental issue is that workers queue for days. Workers battle to access the funds. There's countless issues of corruption. And we've lost faith in the department's ability and the fund's ability to turn things around.
You've used very strong language around the appointment of the acting commissioner, Thulani Chafuta. Why does COSATU see this particular appointment as such a serious matter?
Because he's not qualified. Public service regulations require that anybody who's appointed an acting position, especially HOD in the public service, should be within the public service. You can't just grab somebody from outside. Community constituency network, which he leads, has conflict of interest because they actively tender for these labour activation programs. So there's a need to ensure that persons appointed are persons of credibility.
Is the problem then with the person itself, as you say, lack of experience, or is it the process that was followed as well?
It's both. There was no consultation with social partners. The boards were not consulted. Person lacks the skills. Person has a direct conflict of interest. And these are institutions which we must jealously protect as workers. It's workers' funds. It's not to feather the nests of anybody else, especially tenderpreneurs. And there's been constant allegation of corruption, so we must be extremely hawkish and protect workers. But we can't get it right if we're not appointing the correct people. We should have appointed somebody from the South African Revenue Service or a senior leader in the public service, somebody with the capacity to turn things around, not just grabbing anybody, especially not to violate the public service regulations, which require an internal appointment, and also to have somebody with the capacity who understands the insurance obligation of the state and who can really turn things around quickly.
As a result, Business Unity South Africa has walked away from the UIF board. Matthew, does COSATU understand that decision, or do you think business maybe should have stayed in the room and tried to fix things from within?
Both. We understand the frustrations. We share the frustrations. We've had endless engagements, no progress. But also we've cautioned business to avoid walking out because we need to be in the room to discuss. But nonetheless, you know, their point is a powerful point. We've raised with government that social partners have lost faith in the department or the funds to fix things, and there's now a need for the president to intervene decisively.
So when you raise this with government, who specifically have you raised it with recently, and what sort of response have you had, and are you satisfied, patently not, with the response if you've received one at all?
We've raised with all levels, at NEDLAC, at Parliament, with the Ministry, with the Department, with the funds, with the Presidency. In fact, today we are meeting the President himself to see how can these issues be resolved.
If government doesn't reverse or review the appointment of Mr. Chafuta, what is COSATU's next move?
Well, we'll take it one step at a time. But for our side, it's a point of no negotiation, no compromise. He can't be entrusted to lead these funds. These are too important. We need to have a fit-for-purpose leadership. So hence, we are engaging with the president, and we're hoping that we can find a way forward.
It's going to be very difficult, though, whatever happens, to restore trust in the fact that the contributions are being protected, whatever new solution comes out of the process, if in fact it does.
The only way you'll rebuild trust is if you deal with the issue of corruption, if you appoint competent management, if you put in place modern IT systems where workers and employers can register and receive their monies, where there can be a real turnaround. Until then, PowerPoints won't do it. We need to see real action. It's been far too long.
Are you concerned about talk around privatizing the UIF?
No, you can't privatize it because it's a state function. They want to unbundle it, which means shifting from the public service where it's located to a public sector entity like SARS or CCMA. So it's not privatization, but it's outside the public service framework, which we think itself is a matter of concern.
Why would that be?
Often we've seen government departments want to move things from the public service to public sector entities because then they're outside of the public service wage caps on senior management. We think that's an inherent conflict of interest. And we must address issues within the state. We can't just simply keep restructuring. We need to deal with the real issues of competent management, modern systems, corruption, and so forth.
And just a final question, Matthew Parks. Is there anything that can be done immediately to clear the backlogs that you referenced earlier?
It's going to take some time, and you need to get reinforcements, especially from SARS. We've been having this discussion since COVID, and the department has not moved, and so it's going to need some time. But we think this thing can be fixed. It should not take us more than a few months. 6 months at most. There is the capacity in SARS and the state to do it. But while you do that, you do have to simultaneously process applications, so that does require some reinforcing as well.
Matthew Parks, the Parliamentary Coordinator for COSATU, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, after years of difficulty, what am I talking about? Load shedding, a battered rand and political jitters. South African markets, as you're well aware and as we've reported, are suddenly having a better run. And investors are asking an obvious question whether it is time to bring their offshore money home. Our next guest is going to say maybe, but not so fast. I'm going to talk to Johan Minnie, who's Chief Executive Officer of Consult at Momentum. Johan, a very warm welcome. You call this moment one of green shoots, but not proof of structural improvement. But you also say local assets deserve more attention than they did 5 years ago. So which is it? Are we seeing something of a re-rating of South Africa or not?
Yes, I think it's exactly that. I think that from a general public perspective, the worries that we used to have are not going away, but they are getting less. So I think that to some extent, we see some hope with regards to the political environment. When we look at the rand over the last year, it's been fairly stable. When we look at load shedding, it's maybe something of a distant past. And those things have an emotional effect on people. And I think to some extent that is better. That makes us feel better. That makes us think that, you know, maybe South Africa is the country that we can, again, live in, investing and so forth. But I think we should understand that investing and just being a patriot are two different things. And that is really the point here.
And it's a difficult one because it's impossible at this stage to call it definitively. So really hard for an ordinary investor to make any kind of reallocation decision based on something which effectively is too early to judge.
Yes, it is. And I think that most investors are also driven by one of two emotions. The one is fear and the other one is greed. And fear really says that, you know, what if I lose my money? And greed says, what if I lose out? So I think in the main, most people are trying to time the market. And that is something that one shouldn't try to do. You will often hear around, you know, the fire or the dinner table that people say, I bought just at the right time and I made so much, you know, in this investment. That's luck. I think that, you know, when you sit with your financial advisor and you really understand what is your time horizon, what is it that you're investing for? What are those reasons? What is your risk tolerance? And what is your relationship with money? At this point in time, I think that those questions underlying fundamentals are still very important. So have those discussions. I do think that there are green shoots in South Africa that one should consider.
Let me pick you up on two of those issues. One is the time horizon. How does a person at any particular age determine what that time horizon is? And then I think you raise an even more important question about what am I investing for? But how do you work around that time horizon?
Look, the seventh wonder of the world is compound interest.
Indeed.
So any person should start to save as early as possible, because then you get interest on interest. So the time horizon in normal circumstances should be as long as possible. But then I often get the question, is it too late? It's never too late to start to save or too late to start to invest. But I think it is important to understand, so if I'm investing or saving for an asset, let's say I want to buy a car or I want to put down a deposit on a flat or a house, that is very different to I am now saving for retirement. I think saving for retirement is a long-term investing. You need to understand what are the risks, you know, in the early days of investing versus getting closer to retirement and having the possibility to lose a lot of money in your retirement fund. And I think that is the time horizon question that really needs to be asked. What is it? Is it 5 years, 15 years, 30 years, or maybe 50 years?
And to the question about what am I investing for, that's going to change surely the older you get.
It will. No, without a doubt. It will. I mean, priorities just change. Although societies these days are not the same as it used to be. You know, we used to think that, you know, a person gets born, then they go to sort of nursery school, they go to primary school, then secondary school, university, start a job, have kids, empty nest, retire. I think those paradigms are out of the market at the moment to a very large degree. People don't necessarily get married when they're 25 or 30. Some of them get married when they're 45 or 50. They don't have kids. They do different things. And I think those unique and specific needs are very important when it comes to investing and investment strategy.
And once you've made that decision, Johan, how do you start then determining what the right onshore-offshore split is?
Yeah, Jeremy, you're talking about diversification and asset classes. So, and again, in the new world, there are very different types of asset classes to just the normal ones that that used to be there. So whether it's bonds, whether it's cash, whether it's equities, these days you have alternative asset classes, you've got hedge funds, etc. And I think investors need to really understand what the differences are, because each one of them have a different risk tolerance and they have a different risk attached to it. So if you're a conservative investor and you are really afraid of losing money, you shouldn't go into offshore hedge funds, for instance, or alternative energy, into data things at this point in time. I do think that, you know, then maybe low risk equity, bonds, etc. would be a lot more, and even cash would be a lot more applicable. But I think that investors need to understand those. And I think the psychology of money is these days as important to the risk tolerance of an individual. So that's the way that you see yourself and your relationship with money. Two people with the same risk tolerance may have a different psychology towards money. And again, I think that a very good financial advisor will be able to assist in that regard.
You also suggest that markets often move ahead of economic reality, meaning good news is already priced in. Johan, does that mean that the South African recovery trade may already be over for anyone putting new money in today?
Look, I guess the simple question is, if I knew the answer, you know,
we wouldn't be having this conversation, right?
Exactly. But it is a fact that, you know, traders have most probably priced in a lot into different stocks, etc. But when you look at just what's happened today, you know, so last week resources were sort of the darling. This week it's something different. I mean, obviously with what's happening in the Middle East at the moment, so Sasol has again risen again. And therefore, I think, again, it's just the understanding of what it is that you want to do. And you will find with your financial advisor somewhere, something in the market. And whether it's a stock, if that is what you want to do, a share, and or a unit trust of some sort that will fit your profile. And then more important, Jeremy, is to say, so how long will I be in this fund and or share? Is it going to be, am I going to trade it on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, or will I be here for 5 years, minimum 5 years, unless there's a big correction in the market? What is my stop loss?
And just finally, you've also got to take into account, I guess, the bigger macro picture. So you cite low growth, stubborn unemployment as reasons for caution, all well and good. We also know, Johan, these are not getting fixed anytime soon. So what needs to change for you to tell a client to increase local exposure?
Look, again, I think so if we say as a blanket statement, you know, a lot of the fundamentals inside of our country need to show positive signs, and I don't think that we are there as yet. There may be people that differ from me, but that's exactly why the market is dynamic. Some people may say, listen, you know, we're already on the up. You know, we had this argument about gold. Was it going to go to $6,000 when it was at 3,000? And it sort of almost got to 6,000. But a lot of people said, you know, when it gets to 4,000, I'm going to be out of there. And I think for every buyer, there is a seller. And that is diversification. So don't have your eggs all in one basket. I think that our growth rate is on the up. I think our political situation is stabilizing to some extent. We'll see with the local government elections later this year what's going to happen. But keep your finger on the pulse and just be aware what's happening out in the market. But don't then go and make decisions based on emotions. Do it in a rational way.
Well, let's end this conversation on that note of optimism. Johan, many thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Consult at Momentum. And on that note, we're going to bring today's program to a close. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.